Parnassus Foundation. Dublin. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublin. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello, could I please speak with Forrest Gander?
Hi, Paul. This is Forrest Gander. It's really good to hear your brilliantly empathic voice.
Well, thank you. I'm so excited to be speaking with you, and so delighted that you are part of the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. Tell me, in starting, Forrest, can you tell me where I find you, and perhaps a more difficult question, which we will unpack as we speak, how you have been living these last delirious 18 months or so.
Yes. Right now, I have flown across the country from where I live in Northern California to be with my sister, Karen, who has ALS and is living in Bethany Beach, Delaware.
That must be a painful place to be.
It's sort of an amazing place to be. I'm so glad to get to spend time with her now, and she has the most amazing attitude towards her illness. And she smiles a lot, and she gets the best she can out of each day.
It seems like she might have inherited that in part from your mother.
That's so funny that you say that. That's so remarkable. That's exactly the case. My mother was just like that, indomitable in her enthusiasms all the way into her, you know, the depths of her Alzheimer's.
You know, remarkable as it may be, I must say when I wrote to you not long ago that I was joyously anticipating speaking with you, I think that Forrest Gander, in part, has created a poetics of joy.
Well, I think I've been at both ends of that. In fact, my book Be With was a book of a lot of grief, but I don't think we can let our grief sap from us the meanings of being alive. And one of those meanings is connected to feeling the joy of being alive. And my sister's a real living lesson for me.
You know, there is a philosopher, a French philosopher named Clément Rosset, who wrote quite brilliantly about joy, which is not a subject that philosophers are necessarily prone to investigating. And one of the things he did, Forrest, which I think is so compelling, is he said, when you say the word joie in French, your mouth opens as if it expressed that very joy. And that, you know, in preparing to speak with you, insofar that we can prepare to speak with anyone, I was reminded, and that's why I spoke about nearly a poetics of joy despite everything, and precisely because you take into account the tragedy of this moment, which we'll come to. But let's start with joy. I was reminded of Jack Gilbert's great poem, which you probably know well, I imagine.
A Brief for the Defense.
Oh, my goodness. Well, goodness. Where he begins with sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else. And then he continues a bit lower. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our tension is to praise the devil. And this, reading this poem again, as I was reading your poetry, brought them together, or to use a maybe Forrest Gander word, mingled, co-mingled, Jack Gilbert with you.
Yes, Jack was a longtime friend of mine, stayed at my house a number of times, called it a ruined temple. and I love his work, and I love your reading of that poem. And what you said before also really moves me about the word joie, opening your mouth, because it makes the connection between language and our bodies so clear. You know, they say that even if we read to ourselves silently, that our Adam's apple moves, that our body is involved in our reading, that our body is involved with language. And I think of poetry as a very embodied art.
Tremendous that you met Jack Gilbert someday, somewhere else, perhaps in person, since we do live in the same state. We might meet someday to talk about Jack Gilbert, who really has become a true passion of mine. But it's this line which in a way will take us slightly away from joy, or place us perhaps more definitely in its midst, where he says, "To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil." How do you understand that, perhaps even in the context of these delirious times we're living through?
I mean, for me, he's saying that we're under attack constantly from the bad news, from the suffering in the world, from our recognition that we don't live in a righteous place. We live in a place that's rife with racism and injustice. And yet, wherever I've been, even among the poorest people in Tibet, I've been in houses where people have painted their walls, where they have art, where they laugh, that to only see the horrors of life, to only feel the anxiety of injustice, is to deny ourselves a very signal part of being alive, and that is being able to share joy. That it's often, you know, the spirituals that kept people feeling hopeful during such a wretched time. Music, laughter, and poetry can do that too, I think.
You know, two lines, as you know, I'm a quotomaniac by profession, but two lines that matter to me greatly. One from Tom Waits, where he says, "Don't plant your bad days. They grow into weeks. The weeks grow into months. Before you know it, you got yourself a bad year. Take it from me. Choke those little bad days. Choke him down to nothing. They're your days. Choke him." And that's Tom Waits. And then the famous, I mean, they're famous lines by Brecht, of course, about writing poetry in dark times. But there's one, I mean, very often we talk about in dark times, will there also be singing? Yes, they will be singing about the dark times.
Yes,
of course. Mm-hmm. But even more apropos, Forrest, to me is, and there are words here to stress, what kind of times are these when to talk about trees is almost a crime, because it implies silence about so many horrors. And in many ways, the almost is so important. And implying that we talk about trees means we won't talk about the horrors is precisely, I think, what Brecht is warning us against. And, you know, we're living in the state of California. We've certainly witnessed many fallen trees.
Right. That's right. Interesting that you mentioned both of those people. My wife and I named our son Brecht after Bertolt Brecht.
This I didn't know.
And I just ran into Tom Waits at my favorite restaurant in my little town, Petaluma, and talked to him about the poet Frank Stanford, who he's a big fan of and who was a poet that I published. But I think what Brecht would know now, too, is that there's no way to talk about injustice without talking about trees, that trees are involved in everything, that there's no such thing as a single tree because trees are connected through root system, through mycelium, to so many other organisms, that our idea that we as humans stand apart from everything else has been shattered by science and the realization that we live in a mutualism, that we are ourselves composed of other organisms, that the whole racist idea of purity of blood is a complete fiction, that not even our DNA is pure.
And a dangerous one.
A completely dangerous one. And that, I think, that has led us into one tragic way of seeing the world after another, one horrific world way of seeing the world after another. And part of the activity of activists and even poets now is to try to find a way to write that will help us feel the engagement that we need to feel for our interrelatedness.
I love the fact that you said, Forrest, even poets. Even poets, because in a way what you're talking about is to believe that we're not connected to the forests in general. And I'm nearly thinking of Baudelaire, the forests as symbols of so many different things, as part of so many different aspects of our life, is hubris. And I'm reminded of June Jordan in that particular context when she says most of the time power has to do with dominance. But poetry is never about dominance. Poetry is powerful, but it cannot even aspire to dominate anyone. It means making a connection. That's what it means. And I think it's in that context that I think you're bringing up even poets.
Yeah, you're wonderfully you're just fantastically referential. That's a beautiful and an apt quote. And it's true. I think that poetry is one of the least predatory activities that a human life can be engaged in.
I love that. Predatory. And in a sense, Forrest, now, you know, you have been interested in that interrelation by working with scientists. And I would love for our listeners, I have just recently learned that about you, but the work you have been doing, how do you pronounce the word, lichens?
Lichens.
Yeah. I'm a linguistic monster, so I didn't really quite know how to pronounce it. But lichens.
Because you have a lot of languages under your belt. Yeah.
And very, very few that I speak very well. But lichens. So you've been working with scientists, and one in particular, about lichens. And if you could talk about that a little bit with us, and also the way in which it might connect to notions, surprisingly perhaps to some, of intimacy.
Yes, I'd love to. And of course, we've been living during this time in a time of strange intimacies, when we've been maybe more intimate with the people that we live with yes, than usual.
Yes.
And it's been, you know, it's been educating. And at the same time, I was working with Ann Pringle, one of the very notable mycologists in the U.S., who taught at Harvard and now runs a lab in Wisconsin at the university. And I worked with her at a research center, a biological research center on Mount Huron, where I began to learn a great deal about both fungus and lichens, which a lot of us remember learning in high school with some kind of combination of a fungus and an algae or a cyanobacteria that somehow get together. And I remember learning the word synergy in high school. But it's actually much more complicated than that, and it's more than just two things that get together. And the fascinating thing for me is, I mean, it turns out that even scientists now, with all we know, they don't really know what lichen. And it's pronounced both ways, with an S and singularly, lichen or lichens. They don't really know what it is. In some ways, it acts even more like an animal than it acts like a plant. And the things that compose it, that, you know, algae and that fungus, when they come together, they're transformed permanently. They can never go back to what they were. And they no longer act as they acted when they were single. They take on completely different roles. They're transformed by their alliance. And, you know, that made me think of the nature of intimacy, of human intimacy, and how when we come together with someone, we're transformed. And Anne believes that it's possible that that lichen, which can reproduce itself without asexually, perhaps forever, that it has perhaps, it's one of a number of species that may have a kind of theoretical immortality. And that also made me think of the nature of human intimacy. So through my book, Twice Alive, I'm using lichen as a kind of inspiration to think about mutualism and intimacy and the way that we're transformed by our relations with others.
But also in Be With, you begin with this line, tremendously inspiring to me, which maybe you can help me unpack a little bit, where you write, the political begins in intimacy, which of course made me also think, where does it end?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting follow-up question. But I do think that we learn more about a person's ethics by seeing how they treat the people around them than in how they give a talk on what people should do or what our alliances should be, that it's in our closest relationships that our real ethics are displayed, not in our sort of posturing or intellectualizing of those concerns.
It reminded me, in reading this and hearing you talk now, of a conversation I had with John Freeman not long ago, where we spoke
about... I listened to that. Uh-huh.
And we spoke about Barry Lopez, who, you know, mattered to me so greatly, and I feel
right
so forsaken for not having, as it were, followed up to his invitation to come and visit. I mean, these things are a tremendous... I mean, the grief and mourning and loss one has of opportunities like that is forever present. And John has such a beautiful line where he says that Barry Lopez, maybe much like you, who believe so deeply in collaboration, never spoke from a perch, but spoke from a porch.
That's great. Yeah. Uh-huh. I love that talk you have with John. And I introduced and interviewed Barry Lopez at his very last reading, which was in Point Reyes, California.
At that beautiful bookstore.
That's just a legendarily great bookstore. I drool as soon as I enter through the door. And Barry Lopez was tired, but was beautifully, beautifully present and engaged with people. And I love that. That really matters to me. The difference between the poet who, or the writer, it often happens with poetry, who sort of wraps a cloak around themselves and gives the reading and says the same comments that the poet has said in every other reading and the jokes. And it's a rehearsed performance, as opposed to those like Barry Lopez or like Robert Creeley, who insisted on being present at the moment and being engaged unpredictably with those who surrounded him at any moment.
You know, when I spoke about collaboration, another form of collaboration that I think exists in you and which possibly is as important as your own poetic writing and maybe another form of it, which brings you, I think, close to another poet I so much adore, W.S. Merwin, your work of translation. And I'm wondering if you might not talk a little bit about who you've been translating as of recently and maybe even during the pandemic, and perhaps give us the pleasure of a reading of one or two of those poems and tell us something about those poets you felt a need to translate.
Oh, that's great. I would love to do that. Part of wanting to be with other people during a time when we couldn't be with other people led me to a more intense translation activity during the pandemic. And I worked mainly on two books. One, where I was co-translating a Japanese poet named Shuri Kido, and one where I was translating a great Mexican poet who I had translated before. And her most recent book, her name is Coral Bracho. Her most recent book, which in English would be called It Must Be a Misunderstanding, was about her mother in the late stages of Alzheimer's, partly because my mother also died of Alzheimer's. I was really receptive, hungry to read about this. And of all the people who have been confused and adrift during the changes during the quarantine, during the pandemic, people with Alzheimer's were the most lost. My mother ended up being, you know, in a hospital because she broke her hip, and she didn't know where she was. She didn't know why she was surrounded with people whose faces she couldn't see. She didn't know why she was in such pain. And her only grounding, which was the presence of my sister and me, was denied. We weren't allowed to enter the hospital or even the rehab unit. So when I read Coral Bracho's book, which is so beautiful, it's not at all lugubrious. It's a kind of celebration of her mother. It moved me deeply. And also translating from a book that's about Alzheimer's from another language like Spanish presents some particular problems, because the pronouns that happen in Spanish are not as specific as they are in English. So if in one line a man and a woman are talking about a jaguar, for instance, and in the next line the poet writes, "Tiene una mirada tranquila," the translator has to make a decision about whether it's the man, the woman, or the jaguar that has a tranquil look. And when the person that's being written about is completely confused also, it just be some guessing going on. So here's a short, here are two short poems from Coral Bracho's Debe Ser Un Malentendido, It Must Be a Misunderstanding.
Thank you.
Observation. The puzzle pieces get lost, but not the look she knows to be hers. The forms, the objects, they merge, they crumble, but a feeling for the ensemble remains. Between moments, between fictions, despite constant fractures, like a threshold, a handhold. And here's another observation. That bird, dropping down to peck the asphalt, so close to her foot, is something she's never encountered before. There's nothing to compare it with. Nothing that links it to that cat, nothing it shares with that bush. They're all unanticipated tenants, convincing presences in a space that for the moment we share with them. There aren't kingdoms that harbor them or separate them out into their particular territories. No words that link them together. This thing here, fluttering its wings now and hopping between the grass and the dust. It has no likeness.
This is tremendous, Forrest.
She's a great poet.
Is this going to be published anytime soon?
Yes, it comes out from New Directions next year.
How wonderful, how wonderful. And you yourself have been working in an ancient form, an Indian ancient form, and I'd love for you, if you would, read from Twice Alive, perhaps Immigrant Sea.
Okay, sure. So this, the form that you're talking about is called Sangam, which means coming together. There was a great flourishing of literature, and particularly poetry, in southern India and Tamil Nadu in between 300 BC and 300 AD, or Common Era, CE. And the poetry then, especially this poetry called Akam, linked human emotion, subjectivity, to landscape, as though you couldn't talk about your emotion without also talking about the landscape, where it took place. And in some ways, it seems very anticipatory of what people are now calling eco-poetics.
Yes.
So it takes place in southern India in five major landscapes, which, as I began reading about Sangam literature, I realized are the same five major landscapes of the state that you and I live in, Paul. And one is the sea. And so this is immigrant sea from Twice Alive. Aroused by her inaccessibility, he aches for more of her life to live inside him, watching the breakers, standing so close he can feel heat coming off her wet scalp. What is his relation to this person before him, so familiar and foreign? The way he searches out her face, he searches out himself. Gusts thrash crests of swell. Spring grasses twirl circles in the sand where they stand without speaking. She wants him to know it's all charged, even grass, positive, pollen, negative. So when grass waves, it sweeps the air for pollen. He feels electricity all around, as though the wild drama of the coming storm were already aware of them, foreigners on this shore. Little sapphire blue flowers speckle the dunes. He wonders if he has let himself flatten out into a depthless sheet, like escalator stairs, whether in the end he'll disappear underground without the smallest lurch of resistance. But when her lavish face turns toward him, beaming, the corners of her eyes wind wet, he yields to that excess. He reappears to himself.
When did you write this?
Well, I wrote that in, I guess, just before the pandemic began, when I was reading Sangam poetry, which I'd been turned on to by my partner, Ashwini Bhatt, who is from southern India and who is an immigrant to this country, and thinking about immigration and Trump and the ocean as a constant immigrant to the shore. That's when I wrote it.
So many things come together in the poem you just read, and in our conversation, I feel there is something like an organized web of obsessions that come again and again, and the mingling, I mean, the ocean as a great, grand mingler, and it brought to mind, in my mind, of this merging, this extraordinary moment in John Berger, where he writes, "What reconciles me to my own death more than anything else is the image of a place. A place where your bones and mine are buried, thrown, uncovered together. They are strewn there pell-mell. One of your ribs leans against my skull. A metacarpal of my left hand lies inside your pelvis. Against my broken ribs, your breast like a flower. The 100 bones of our feet are scattered like gravel. It is strange that this image of our proximity, concerning as it does, mere phosphate of calcium, should bestow a sense of peace. Yet it does. With you, I can imagine a place where to be phosphate of calcium is enough." I wonder how that speaks to you in this moment, as it were.
John Berger constantly speaks to me in almost every moment. I love his language and his attentiveness. And I do love that image. It's a beautiful one to bring up, Paul, of the dissemination of the self back into the world that brought it together once and that might again. And I feel at peace with that. It also makes me think of one of the skeletons found in Vesuvius is of a man's bones. He has his right leg over the hips of a woman who is holding a child, and their bones have sort of emerged, but it's clear he was trying to protect them at the last moment. And that gesture is part of what remains in the uncoming of their cells and their bones and remingling with the magma of the earth.
You just did something for me which to my mind demonstrates or proves in the best way of what the word proof might mean, the power of an image and of language, namely that I will never be able to read this John Berger moment without thinking of that image you just brought up of the Vesuvius. I feel that in closing, very sadly, might I add, I'd love you to read a poem that you published in The New Yorker really recently, in just a few months ago, in April. And in a way, it will leave us on this notion of the misery and the necessity of joy and the ethical implications of joy in a time of misery. But I don't want to say more because I really don't have more to say except to ask you to read, if you would, Post-Fire Forest.
Glad to. Thank you so much, Paul. Post-fire forest, shadows of shadows without canopy, phalanxes of carbonized trunks and snags, their inner momentum shorted out. They surround us in early morning like plutonic pillars, like mute clairvoyance leading a sursum corda, like the excrescence of some long slaughter. All that moves is mist lifting, too indistinct to be called ghostly, from scorched filamental layers of rain-moistened earth. What remains of the forest takes place in the exclamatory mode, cindered utterances in a tongue from which everything trivial has been volatilized, everything trivial to fire. In a notch between hills stubbled with black paroxysm, we spot a familiar sun, liquid glass globed at the blowpipe's tip. If this landscape is dreaming, it must dream itself awake. You have, everyone notes, a rare talent for happiness. I wonder how to value that, walking through wreckage. On the second day, a black-backed woodpecker answers your call, but we search until twilight without finding it.
A rare talent for happiness. Of course, it brought up so many other images. It brought up what we began by speaking about with when I mentioned Clément Rosset, who really did believe that joy is deeper than sadness. And it also brought up the very first lines of C.D. Wright's Crescent, where she writes, "In recent months, I've become intent on seizing happiness." It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, I'm so glad you know that, Paul.
Oh, of course. It's been...
That moves me deeply.
But it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. And when you return from this very important moment you're spending with your sister, and when we can, I just hope we will have a moment to sit on a porch and do away with any form of perch and speak to each other.
I would love that, and I've really loved your conversations, and thank you for them.
Thank you so much. Take care, Forrest.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.